Well, good morning. I'm calling this meeting of the House Committee on Children, Families, Finance, and Policy to order. Welcome to everybody. Members of the public, there are materials posted on our website. And for those in the room, that the collection of papers near the front of the room, you can feel free to grab as well. We're going to start, as usual, by having the clerk take the roll. I should note that a number of folks are running late because of the weather. And so we'll have a few people who are excused, and it'll be okay. So, Ms. Kahn, we'll start with that.
Chair Pinto.
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler.
Present.
Lee Daniels.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Coulter.
Present.
Representative Davis.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Present.
Representative Hicks.
Present.
Representative Hudson. Representative Katiza-Watun.
Yeah, she is excused. She's running a little bit late.
Representative Lee.
I think the same thing.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Perez-Vega.
And I think the same for her as well.
Representative Zalesnikar.
And I suspect that's the same for her, too. So folks will be coming in. We next have our minutes from our meeting of February 21st, pardon me. Representative Keeler, you have a motion with respect to the minutes?
So moved.
Okay, so the motion is to approve the minutes of February 21. Any additions or corrections, members? So hearing none, all in favor of approval of those minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, motion passes, and the minutes are approved for February 21. So members, we have four bills up today. I think that we were going to make a switch, if it's okay with Representative Hansen. I think Representative Hicks was requesting to have her bills up first. Is that correct? No problem either way. Okay. Okay, yeah, so then let's have Representative Hansen. Yep, I maybe had misunderstood the request there. So Representative Hansen, then, you're up first, so head on up, please. And Representative Hansen moves House File 1479 to bring that before the committee. Although, members, just at the outset, the plan is to hear all four of these bills, and they're all four going to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. So Representative Hansen, House File 1479 is before the committee, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair. And I do have a DE amendment.
Ah, yes, thank you. Do you move the DE1 amendment, Representative Hansen?
Yes, please. I'd like to move the DE1 amendment,
okay.
Please.
Any questions, members, about the DE1 amendment? Just put in the bill in the form that the author wishes. All in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The DE1 amendment is adopted, so the bill is in the form you wish, Representative Hansen, and please present your amended bill.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, committee members. Just to clarify, the DE amendment for 1479 did, in fact, align the bill. It aligns it with an initiative that's already in the governor's budget. It also aligns with some recommendations, included the child protection removals and reunifications OLA report from last year, and it's with also combined with the original intent of the bill, which was drafted with county social service workers to advocate for reducing paperwork required by county CPS workers. Over the years, we've all heard the calls to improve the social service information system, which is also known as SSIS, that's used by county social workers in the child protection system. From the OLA report last June to stories from frontline CPS workers, this bill seeks to address those concerns and continue to improve the technology so that we can improve the outcomes for children and families who are engaged with the CPS system. The complex and duplicative requirements result in CPS workers spending more time than necessary inputting repetitive or unnecessary information. And we all know that overloaded caseworkers means more burnout, more workforce shortages, and less services delivered. In the end, it's children and families who receive less direct time with their CPS workers during what can be one of the hardest times of their lives. And these complications in systems can even delay reunification or make it too complex for families and parents to follow along. Parents deserve to receive clear, easy-to-understand information about the necessary steps to reuniting with their children. And that is harder to do with the system as it is today. This bill seeks to ensure that we can find specific areas for improvement in SSIS. Assessing the systems and processes that are used to gather this information can help us better understand where complications occur. This bill appropriates $1 million in fiscal year 2024 and $1 million in 2025 for DHS to contract with an outside independent consultant to evaluate SSIS. The consultant must make recommendations for improvements that address technical problems and data entry requirements that are unduly burdensome. DHS must also conduct a study on how to reduce SSIS data entry requirements for child protection cases with a report to the legislature by June 30th of 24. The report must contain procedures for soliciting ongoing feedback and input from stakeholders, a report on the process for soliciting the outside consultant for the SSIS evaluation, and the progress made to improve the user experience. With me today are some county social service providers and social workers who work in the CPS and have personally persevered through the barriers within the SSIS system. And they can tell you more about why these changes are so desperately needed. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. I appreciate you highlighting that this is in the governor's budget as with the amendment we adopted. And so we're hearing members a series of proposals. We're going to end up hearing the governor's budget, I'm hoping, in about 2 weeks, that bill. But I just want to highlight that. So we're going to turn to the testifiers. And my apologies in advance. I hope you've been advised that just because of how crowded the agenda is, you'll have just 2 minutes apiece. And the first person up is Suzanne Artson. And if you can please just identify yourself. I believe you're the first person up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Suzanne Artson, and members, thank you for having us and allowing us to speak for just a couple of minutes today about improvements to SSIS. This bill really does have the opportunity to improve service delivery for vulnerable children and families. Currently, the paperwork or administrative burdens placed on frontline staff are driving staff out of the field. And because what we know is paperwork does not equate to child safety. Child safety is about relationship and engagement. Research tells us that the greatest predictor of a positive outcome in a child protection case is the worker's relationship with the family. But what are we doing to really support and nurture that relationship when workers are spending upwards of 50% of their time doing data entry? What we're looking for is, what we're currently experiencing is a system that's well over 23 years old. It includes opportunities where workers simply can't access the system. That could be one or two times a week. That if you get in, it can take 20, 30, 60 seconds to simply navigate between screens. The system can freeze, resulting in workers losing hours of documentation time. So as the Representative Hansen spoke to, we are looking for a study to fully examine what is the data within SSIS that is clearly connected to state and federal mandates. How do we look to reduce redundancy and duplication within the system? And how do we consider an eye for the future with potentially replacement of SSIS and an identification of a new system that can further enhance the work of the worker so that they can do the hard work with families? Why does it matter? What I can speak is Scott County specifically is experiencing 40 to 50% turnover. And what I hear from staff during every exit interview is one of the leading factors is the unduly paperwork and administrative requirements. Staff come into the field to want to help support families, but what they end up doing is data entry. So I'm going to turn it over now to some of our frontline workers so that they can share their on-the-ground experience.
Thank you so much. And so Samantha Goldman, I believe, is up next. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Samantha Goldman. I'm a resident of Carver County and employed by Scott County. I was a child protection social worker for 9 years in Scott County before my recent transition to a supervisor role. Imagine the following real-life scenario. Catherine, a severe heroin addict, had just had her 18-month-old daughter placed in foster care. Catherine reluctantly meets with her social worker for the first time after 6 weeks of her social worker reaching out and dropping by unexpectedly. The social worker spends time learning about Catherine and finding ways to build her trust as her advocate. Catherine can tell her story and feels heard. Catherine begins to take small steps towards addressing her addiction, and for the first time in a long time, Catherine feels empowered to make changes for herself and her daughter. Behind the scenes, the worker is trying now to develop an out-of-home placement plan, document all case activities, and complete redundant screens in SSIS. That's assuming SSIS is not having technical difficulties and the worker doesn't get kicked out of the system, previous work doesn't get saved so they have to redo it, and it takes multiple clicks to get through one screen. The demands of the documentation become too overwhelming, leading the social worker to quit. Catherine's case gets reassigned. Catherine experiences this change in additional time over the next 6 months, totaling 3 new workers in 9 months. Catherine loses trust. Catherine is asked to tell and retell her story. She fears her daughter's needs get lost in all these transitions, and she shuts down because what is the point? The new social worker cannot get Catherine to engage any further. The foundation of good social work is relationship building and trust. I have seen so many great social workers lose their spark because they are overwhelmed overworked and overwhelmed with paperwork demands. These demands negatively impact a social worker's ability to actually do social work, and workers are spending 50% of their time completing paperwork and clicks rather than directly working with children and families.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. And next, I think it's Shelby Dorr.
Yes.
Identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Shelby Dorr, and I'm Hennepin County Child Protection Social Worker, and I've been here for 6.5 years. In child protection throughout the state of Minnesota, we use a system called SSIS. This is the system that holds basic information of our caseloads, case plans, case notes, and assessments. This system is a significant hindrance on how the child protection workers in Minnesota are able to provide services to the families and help assist safety for the children. SSIS is not user-friendly, as it is not always accessible. For example, last Thursday, the 23rd, I had to access my supervisor to therefore access my case notes to do my court documentation because my SSIS just was this black screen of nothingness. SSIS runs slower when more people are on the system, so a lot of us use Fridays for our paperwork, catch-up days, etc. Unfortunately, when so many of us are on the system, it's super slow, which then forces us to not have a very good work-life balance because a lot of us are working into the evenings or on the weekends to make up for that time lost and to get caught up on our case plans and case notes. Workers have also shared with me that they have been told that given the timeliness of documentation, they may be overlooked for leadership opportunities and or to also have it be reflected in their interview. But how is that an accurate depiction of the individual when the system itself is not working properly? SSIS information doesn't populate onto our referrals, and so we're also wasting a lot of our time reiterating names, dates of birth, SSIS work group numbers, all of those things. And so, therefore, it should be auto-populated onto our referrals to save us that time. It's also hard to figure out which documents on SSIS need to be completed, and it'd be nice to streamline that as well. This job is hard. The system supporting the role should not be adding to the feeling of being overwhelmed. Technology is supposed to support us and make our job easier and help navigate all the things. Workers are bombarded with documentation in this role, which is taking away from why many of us get into this field, to help families navigate through the situation and help connect them with resources to make their homes and families safer. CPS is a hard job, but then you add the unnecessary stress of a system that doesn't have the technology to support its workforce, which is easy to program, and we wonder why the caseloads are so high, workers are leaving, families don't feel supported, the permanency timelines aren't met, and the children are on out-of-home placement for even longer. Because of the burnout, because of the turnover, because of the unnecessary rules and regulations that we have to navigate. In order for CPS to be better, we as a community have to do better. Child protection social workers need to be supported so that we can better support our families and help our communities thrive. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And so our final testifier, if you can please identify yourself, Katie Trippinier, I think. But you can please identify yourself, proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Katie Trepanier, and I'm a licensed social worker in Minnesota. I work for Washington County Child Protection. I am here today to talk about the out-of-home placement plan, which is a case plan that is created with parents when their children have been removed from their care. It details child's needs, safety concerns, and what the parent needs to do to be reunified with their children. These documents range anywhere from 15 to 30 pages for each child and each custodial parent. This results in multiple 15 to 30 page documents that have different information being given to a parent. This is overwhelming and confusing. The 2022 OLA report recommended a 1 to 2 page case plan to clearly and concisely state what is needed. When parents come into the child protection system, it's a time of high stress and tension, and parents are oftentimes not in a place to emotionally absorb that information. The expectation for workers is that this case plan is completed and filed with the court within 30 days of removal, which is often just 2 weeks after an ongoing worker gets the case. There is not adequate time to build a relationship and rapport with our clients. And we know that our working relationship with our clients is highly influential in the outcome of the case. The SSIS system and the other, the out-of-home placement plan is created in the SSIS system, which often malfunctions, is extremely slow, and adds hours onto the process of creating documents. It often quits and loses work that workers have already spent a significant amount of time on and is not always accessible. The out-of-home placement plan takes a large percent of percentage of a worker's time, up to 10-plus hours for an initial out-of-home placement plan between the case planning meeting, creating the document, reviewing it with the parent and other parties, and obtaining signatures. When faced with a client crisis or a client needing something tangible, all workers will put off the paperwork requirement to meet the needs of their client. This requirement to complete the paperwork does not go away when unforeseen circumstances arise. This creates a situation where workers are working overtime often, losing the work-life balance and self-care opportunities that allow them to continue doing this work, and ultimately leads to burnout and turnover. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Panier. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Not seeing any. And I'll just note to the four testifiers, you could not be doing more important work. So you have our gratitude for protecting vulnerable kids and supporting their families. Thank you so much. I think we're ready, Representative Hansen, unless you disagree, to move to discussion. Representative Hansen, is that okay? We're ready for that. So member discussion or questions? Representative Hicks.
I just wanted to say thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this, and thank you all for sharing your stories. I actually just texted a case manager who's a good, really important person in our life, and thanked her for dealing with SISS, because I can't imagine how frustrating that must be for all of you. So I hope that we can help improve this system so you can do the actual part of your job.
I've interacted with SSIS a bit in my role as a prosecutor, and yeah, there's some challenges there. Mm-hmm. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hansen, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's when I had first gotten elected in the special election in 2019, I kind of naively picked up the request from my county, being in the minority, to carry forward dealing specifically with ICWA, but very much of the same issue of the there's a lot of paperwork requirements. Now, we need to have checks and balances, and I appreciate that. But at the same time, their frustration was much of what was brought up by the child care workers that are here today, of the reporting requirements, the duplicity of the system, the glitches, it was slow. And then for the counties that have, are working with tribes, there's ICWA. That's a whole nother level, another layer that they're working with, and it just challenges it that much more. And, many of those counties are spending more than 50% of their time on paperwork and not helping the children and the families that are needed. And I thank you for this. I think it's very important that we do this. But I hope also that this goes beyond a study. That's one of my concerns, is that, we do a study and then it gets put on a shelf, and unfortunately too many times the study was conducted and nothing has ended up carried out and done. Very likely we're going to have to invest some finances in changing in the outcome of this. But one of the social workers in the one of the counties I represent, they were pushing DHS one time of what is needed, what do we have to have, and they said, well, kind of the answer they got back is, well, we need all the forms, we don't ever look at them, but we need them all filled out and turned in. And the frustration that came from the hours of hard work that you do, making sure every form is filled out, every box is checked that's appropriate, and then hearing from DHS that, oh, we don't even look at them, we're required to have them filled out. And that's, there's, I think, definitely some room for the agencies to get reined in on some of these. Some of them are requirements that we have, as a legislature, have put on them over the years and have not gotten stripped out, have not cleaned up. And I'm hopeful that this can move forward and that some changes can be made, because it's definitely needed.
Representative Hansen, you want to respond to Representative Nelson's question about this, about kind of just being a study, but something more?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson. I guess my answer to that would be, we have to start somewhere. And when I've been talking about the various things that we can do to improve our child welfare system, it has to be a holistic view. And this is what frontline workers asked for. And it also just happens to align with what the OLA report said and with what the governor's budget is putting forward. So I think that's a win for for all of us when we can all get on the same page to start in the same place. I highly expect that the recommendations from this study be something that we implement. Should we, you know, have the discussion about that and make sure that it's addressing all the needs that we see as legislators here as well? So I guess that'd be my answer.
So we got a few members on. I'm just going to ask folks to keep your questions real short if you can. That was perhaps a little bit longer of Nelson, but just because we've got four we have four bills to get through, I know there'll be a lot of discussion on all of this. Representative Zelesnikar, you're up next.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Representative Hansen. I'll go quick. First of all, thank you for doing this. I'm helping a family that, and I have a couple questions, moved from Duluth and to another county. And I've seen the paperwork mishaps happen for families every day. And so my question is, do you see this system, whatever we come up with, being able to have language that moves from county? People do move. And so that the data is not replicated, because I'm hearing from county caseworkers the time they're spending on assessments is just monumental, and the data is not following when children have to get placed out of the area.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. Assessments are one of the most important parts of a social worker's job. It's making sure that we can do a needs assessment, we understand fully what's happening within the household, with the family, with the child, all of that. So I agree with you that that data should absolutely move. There are times where if you get a case that's from another county, you may have to do your own assessment because the situation may have changed. So I can't say that it will absolutely eliminate the need for a multiple assessments, but at the same time, you can gather quite a bit of information from your peers when you pick up a case from another county. And so I don't know, I can't say what the final system will actually do, but what I can say is that this study will help us find where those issues are and make sure that we can align them as best as possible.
Thank you.
And I think just having the data baseline will be helpful. My second question is, in the language with child welfare, there's a lot of language on neglect, abuse, definitions. And so for the professionals that are writing the care plans, whichever word you use in the world of child care, but a care plan after an assessment, if those care plan needs aren't met from what you outline because the paperwork is delayed, somebody just testified that social workers and teams, which I agree, are going to go take care of the family and the child before getting the paperwork. So are there fines assessed to you as a professional if you're not able to get the paperwork compliance done? Are you assessed deficiencies for not being able to do that as professionals?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. I'll let my testifier speak to specifically fines, but what I want to highlight is that when we have these issues, children, their futures, their ACE scores, families, that's affected, and that has no cost on it. That's invaluable, so we have to do our best to make sure we're protecting that at all costs.
Any question? Yeah, please.
Good morning. In regards to the fine question, yes, is the short answer. When our out-of-home placement plans are not completed within a certain amount of time, then DHS comes back to us and doesn't provide the funding to the county for the foster care payments. And so that's coming out of the county budget.
Okay, good. Representative, so Representative Keeler. Yeah, and then Representative Bliss is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be really fast. And thank you, Representative Nelson, for bringing up ICWA and MIFBA in all of this. One of the things in the OLA report that they actually missed was tribal notifications. Mm-hmm. And so I guess for me, a question to you or somebody, one of the testifiers, is in this study, how are we going to make sure that, one, it's culturally infused and knowledgeable about what we're doing here in Minnesota? It's not some outside entity from another country that's overviewing what we're doing. So how are we making sure that it's culturally infused with our tribal nations? And how are we going to make sure that in the study we actually address MIFBA and ICWA in that tribal notification piece? Because as Representative Nelson mentioned, our counties and our tribes are not working together, I mean, in general, but definitely not systematically. And I think that we have to update this to be the most efficient and effective that it can be, where it's 2023 and technology mm-hmm. should not be the thing that's slowing us down. Mm-hmm. So the culturally infused piece is, I guess, where the question is.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Keeler, for the question. As we work to codify MIFBA here, I think that's going to be the most important step, because what this study will do will make sure that we're looking at existing statutory requirements and what the limitations of SSIS are. So step one, codify MIFBA and codify ICWA into MIFBA. Make sure we can get that done so that once this study is conducted, we can match everything up. So the report that's coming back on the 24th, I hope that this committee pays attention to it. I know there's a number of us who are interested in making sure that this happens and that it's a priority for us. And so I have made it very clear to DHS, I think a lot of us have, how important it is to align these systems, because if we do that, we continue to fail. But we all know, I said it on the House floor last year, we know better, and now it's time to do better. And so this is definitely part of the conversation.
Representative Bliss, and then we'll go to Representative Daniels quick.
Thank you. Yeah, and Representative Keeler, following up on you. I have 32 years in the tech field, and 10 years ago I implemented systems that would have taken care of this problem overnight. It's 2023. My concern is that we're really good at building silos in the state of Minnesota, meaning we have data set over here, data set over here, data set over here, and I've, through the committees, I've heard people falling through the cracks, abuse on you know, taking advantage of programs. There's systems out there that we can have the caseworkers securely fill out their information on their cell phone as they're at the place, and have a process of a file following a person throughout the life cycle, and securely again, and just please don't limit this to just the SSIS system. It's, we've got silos all over, and we need to get everybody under one roof. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that comment. I am down to invest all the money necessary, all of it, into all of our systems. And I hope that everybody in the legislature agrees, because our kids need it. You know, I have some other bills talking about the islands of care that we have that exist for children's mental health, for example, within adult mental health, some of the missing links between crisis care. And so I've made it part of my career to make sure that we're looking at the issues in Minnesota systemically and at, from a macro perspective. And these are nonpartisan issues. I love how we come together to solve these, and I think we can keep doing more of that. I wish that we could bond for technology, and I think I just want to make that kind of reference here, is that we're not allowed to do that right now. But as we move into the future, I do think that that's something that we should continue to talk about, because the cost of these system changes and building new systems, you know, from being in the tech world, they're spendy. But we need to be able to invest that money into those systems.
Okay, yeah, real quick, Richard Bliss, yeah.
Yeah, there's systems out there that will take care of this. And one of the reasons I love going out to the private sector to get this done is you don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. So as far as investing all the money, if you do it the right way the first time, it's not that expensive.
Great.
Representative Daniels, quick final thing.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. It's been a real robust discussion. I do support the theme that we need to update our technologies. I can just relate for myself, as having to do the year-end report for campaign finance is a real pain in the butt. So, yes, we need to update those. So I'm in support of that, and I'll keep it real short. I just hope we can use, like Representative Bliss said, pieces of the information that are already in place. We don't have to reinvent the wheel like we did on Minlar. So as long as we don't make that mistake again, I think we can move forward and get this technology updated.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. Representative Hansen, quick final words.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. I agree that we need to make smart investments into our systems so that we can do what we all join this committee to do, is to improve the lives of children and families across the state of Minnesota and make sure that every kid has a great start here in Minnesota. So thank you again for your time today, and I appreciate the inclusion of this, and I renew my motion to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Hansen, and again, many thanks to your testifiers, especially for all their work. So with that, the chair lays over House File 1479 as amended for possible inclusion in a budget bill. Representative Hicks, you are up. And so we're going to, as you head up there, I will have your testifiers come on up too. So Representative Hicks moves House File 1661 to bring that before the committee, and I believe that there is an amendment to that bill. And so, Representative Hicks, do you wish to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Okay. And it looks like some technical changes there. Are there any questions folks have to the A1 amendment? So hearing none, all in favor of approval of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So the motion passes, and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Hicks to House File 1661 as amended.
Thank you so much, Chair and members. I want to first thank Lee Daniels for co-authoring this legislation with me. As many of you know, we are a foster family and a kinship foster family, and this is a issue area that's very close and near and dear to my heart. House File 1661 reflects the priorities developed by the Kinship Working Group with participation from advocates, community-based providers, and counties, and DHS. This legislation is needed due to positive and significant shifts within our current welfare system. Over 60% of children in foster care are currently being placed with kinship caregivers and relative caregivers. This is great for children, and these children are being raised by families outside of the foster care system, in many cases informally. Grand family statistics state that one in every one child raised by kin in foster care, there are six being raised by kin outside of foster care in Minnesota. House File 1661 responds to the needs of our informal kinship caregivers who are actively preventing children from entering the child welfare system, and to the needs of our formal kinship caregivers who are increasingly the primary foster parents to Minnesota children in care. I'll walk through the sections of the bill real quickly. Sections 1 and 2 outline a grant program to build service capacity to assist informal kinship caregivers. According to the National Expert Grand Families, 79,096 Minnesotan children are being raised informally by a relative. Kinship caregivers need financial, legal, medical, and kinship resources. A longstanding local model provided by Lutheran Social Services in Minnesota uses groups and workshops, online learning opportunities, and a warm line to support these families. The statewide need for kinship caregivers far exceeds the current resources, especially in greater Minnesota. Expansion of informal kinship supports helps keep families together while preventing child welfare involvement and setting them up for success. Section 3 of the bill invests in an establishment grant program to support formal kinship foster caregivers statewide. Amended language includes an evaluation of the impact of these investments by asking what brings the greatest value to caregivers. National statistics indicate that children who are cared for by their family experience greater stability. And as observed by those serving kinship families, supporting kinship often requires twice the amount of staff and resources as a traditional foster home. Kinship caregivers are asked to transform their lives, to care for children whom they love deeply. Oftentimes, overnight, they need beds, clothing, childcare, transportation, and lots of practical and caring supports to begin parenting the children they love and their families. House File 1661 makes these needed investments that can help support kinship caregivers. I will let my testifiers share their stories now as well.
Thank you so much. And again, my apologies in advance. We'll have to just keep you to 2 minutes apiece. But I think Nomi Badboy is the first person. And so please, perhaps, either way, whoever wants to go, first person identify yourself, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Chair Pinto, members of the committee. My name is Nomi Badboy. I serve as a member of the Kinship Advisory Council. I'm also in my second year with the Transgender Equity Council in Minneapolis. I live in Ward 7 in Minneapolis, and I serve as a board member for the Twin Cities Pride. 4 years ago, I unexpectedly became a kinship caregiver to my two nieces and nephew. I was able to obtain custody of the two older children, and I also adopted my youngest niece. I had to put my full-time career on hold to become a kinship caregiver. Our family had to move three times. We are without food by the end of the month. There are many needs, including after-school activities, school supplies, hygiene, and clothing. My three-year-old niece wants to do ballet, but we do not have the funds to do so. I came to understand quickly that there just isn't enough funding or resources for children. I want to give them the best and most positive life possible. As a member of the Kinship Advisory Council, we are working to help families like mine. We bring our voices and experiences to make sure the supports, services, and resources provided are what caregivers and children need. The big issue are financial resources for our families, housing instability, child care costs, and lack of knowledge of community services. My niece and nephew are now emotionally stable. My niece is happy, bubbly, and full of energy, and she enjoys her preschool education program. My nephew is a teenager now, and he loves to play his PlayStation 4 and plays basketball with his friends. He also enjoys sleepovers. We are a strong family. I hope you will support increased funding to support kinship caregivers and families like mine. Thank you.
Thanks so much, and thanks for your work as a kinship caregiver.
Absolutely.
Thank you. and Linda Buettner, please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, my name is Linda Buettner. I'm a caregiver for three of my grandchildren. They were placed with me 6 years ago. My adoption went through a year ago through Amperson. I got recommended to Amperson program. It was the wonderful program that I got introduced to. They helped me with my licensing, helped me with everything with my grandsons. We're here today to get our voices out because it's so important that the fundings and stuff that we receive for to protect these children and take care of these children, that we need this stuff. Like I said, I have three boys, the age of 11, 9, and 8, and they keep me very busy, sports-wise, school-wise, just everything that, you know, that we have to provide and do for them. I had to change my life around for these three little boys. It was either change my life around or let them go into the system. I refused that because they are my biological grandchildren, and I knew I needed to step up to be there for them because they didn't have no one else to do that. They have me and their grandfather in their lives. They're happy. They are smart, educated, three little boys. We are trying to raise them the best way that we can. I try to keep them active, involved in sports and everything. It's just so important that you guys listen to our bill today to really help support our children out here. Get our words out to protect our children. That's the most important thing. Thank you.
It sure is. Thank you, and thanks for your testimony, and thanks to you for your work as a kinship caregiver, too. Really, thanks to both of you. Any members of the public who wish to testify regarding this bill? I'm not seeing any, and so I think we're ready to move to member questions or discussion. So, members, any that the folks have? Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks, for bringing this forward. I guess for me it's more of an educational opportunity for us to talk about why ICWA and MIFBA is the gold standard when we do placement, because the number one piece of ICWA is that you're placed with your family first. Because we know and we understand that our families know us. They look like us. They understand our history. They can share that with us, and that's extremely important. And so thank you for this, but also keeping in mind that we are moving forward with MIFBA being the gold standard here so that all children can really have this opportunity. So continue with the great work. Thank you.
Good stuff. Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. And so I think there's a good sense here regarding the work that you're doing, Representative Hicks, in this proposal. So I'll go to Lee Daniels for a final word as usual.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I do support this bill. I being a second generation foster parent and my daughter being a third generation, sometimes the goal is always to reunite with a family, and sometimes that's difficult to do, and sometimes that's by law you only have so many hours to reunite the children with somebody in the family. So I like the premises of this bill, and I think it'll give a little variety to finding good homes for children. And the main intent is always reunite the family. So, and I think that's still in the bill's intent. So I'm in favor of it. I'd like to support it, and we'll see what happens down the road, I guess.
Yeah, thank you, Lee Daniels. Actually, I'm just noticing that you are a co-author on the bill. So, in fact, I've lent your name in support, yeah. Which is terrific.
And thank you, Representative Hicks, for authoring the bill as well.
Good stuff. Representative Hicks, final word for you as the bill author.
Thank you so much, Chair and committee members. As a kinship caregiver, I know how alone it can feel when you're not formally in the system and navigating it by yourself. And I've been in the system as a formal foster parent as well. So I understand the difference of support that happens in those situations and in those environments. And I want to make sure that other families like mine and like yours get the support they need to ensure that our children are cared for, loved, safe, and can remain in family and in community.
Thank you, Representative Hicks, and again to your testifiers for their work. I'll note, Representative Hicks, as long as I'm sort of thinking about this, I notice there's a blank appropriation in the bill, and one thing I'll ask you to think about as the committee is considering putting together a budget is sort of, I'm sure, sort of the more funding that could go into this, the better. Are there sort of thresholds where, you know, really a minimum of X would make a difference? Are there sort of milestones where, you know, this, just to sort of think about the amount of money that that you might be seeking for this. And that's something that we can talk about at a later time, potentially. If you have, real quick, if you want to say something, I don't know if Nomi Badgley. Sorry, the amendment has that. Oh, I'm so sorry.
I was just going to say, did it not get in the packets?
I am so sorry, all.
The amendment has that information.
Well, maybe, okay, let me amend my own question. I'm so sorry about that, all. To ask that if it turns out that it can't be these particular amounts, I'm also thinking about that, and I guess I'll ask that of all folks bringing that bringing the dollar amounts before us, and I'm so sorry, members, for that. Representative Hicks, terrific bill. Again, thank you to your testifiers, and with that, the chair does lay over House File 1661 as amended, because it had an amendment, for possible inclusion in a future bill. Thank you so much, and Representative Hicks, you're remaining up there. And have House File 1672. Representative Hicks moves that House File 1672 be brought before the committee. I do not see an amendment to this bill. And so, Representative Hicks, we can just dive in with having you present the bill.
Yes, thank you so much, Chair Pinto and members. 1672 recognizes and supports quality parenting initiatives in Minnesota. QPI, as we call it, is a national movement to improve foster care by welcoming those with lived experience in our own foster system, including birth parents, youth, foster parents, to provide leadership and guidance for implementing the practices that make meaningful differences for children and families. The goal of QPIMN is to support effective, loving parenting for all children and youth in our child welfare system. We see from Minnesota's experiences over the past years that QPI is making a difference here, with opportunity to grow to additional counties, providers, and make an even greater impact for Minnesota families. Today, I have two testifiers with me who will share more about the QPIMN work.
Okay, and I think we're starting with Kate Rickard. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, thank you. My name is Kate Rickard. I'm really grateful to be here. I'm the Director of Quality Parenting Initiative Minnesota, and I've been a supporter since the planning stages in 2016. Chair Pinto and committee members, I'm again grateful for this opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 1672. QPI Minnesota originated with community-based providers gathering together to bring this national movement here to Minnesota because we saw the effects of how it was sparking transformational change in systems across the nation. QPI's goal is to support children every day with excellent parenting when they're in foster care so that they can thrive into adulthood. All are welcome to our QPI table. Getting connected in this network is really simple. It's a phone call, it's an email. We see our youth, our parents, and our foster parents as the change agents and really significant contributors to our work. Our QPI organizations, they direct their practices and policies towards loving, developmentally informed parenting. We actually have a few in here today, so that's kind of exciting to see them. There are several ways you can engage in our system. You can be an individual interested in improving foster care, or you can be a supporting organization who is engaged in action work groups. We currently have 7 counties and 9 community-based providers who have demonstrated commitment to this network through their decisions to have this be an organizational practice. in your materials, there's the QPI principles, as well as a map that outlines the statewide nature of this growing movement. QPI leverages the power of relationships and the firsthand experience of those who have been involved in the system. A few of these practices include early connections between parents and foster parents at the start of a placement. And this is what the majority of us do, right? Like, we share information between adults who are caring for a child. The favorite book at bedtime, the field trip that's coming up they're excited for and they don't want to miss. We see parenting communication as key to the work of QPI. Another piece of our work is youth-led trainings for social workers and foster parents. Our youth leaders range from 13 to 24, are diverse in their culture and in their fostering experience. We had a recent training, What I Need, youth presenting on fostering, and an attendee said, what a great opportunity to hear the voices of the presenters sharing their journeys and improvements towards opportunity to improve the quality of life for fosters. They've spoken at national and statewide conferences, and we are working really hard to support them using their voices in a way that honors experience and doesn't create unintentional harm, because when you share a personal story in a larger community context, we have to be careful about that. We have 30.
I want you to wrap up pretty soon, yeah, if you can.
Training and technical assistance is delivered in a manner that creates a consistent loop of systems change. So we support training in multiple ways. There's hosting action work groups focused on specific goals, or having trained champion leaders embedded in organizations to create change from the ground up. And unlike the 9 other QPI jurisdictions across the country, we've only relied on philanthropic funding and nominal fees from our supporting organizations and counties. So supporting House File 1672 is a small investment that will yield significant change. And with your support, we are ready to extend this transformation to all of our communities in Minnesota, our tribal nations, and our counties. And with you, I think we can do it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your work. Curtis Bell, up next, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and committee members, and thank you for allowing me to come and testify before you on behalf of House File 1672 for QPI. My name is Curtis Bell, and me and my wife, Darlene, have been foster parents for over 35 years. We fostered over 30 kids in that time period. We have 3 boys biologically of our own, but we also have 5 children that we adopted out of foster care over that period of time. We have 19 grandkids and 1 great-grandchild. We managed to do all of this while maintaining professional lives as well. Darlene and I both serve as QPI champions in Minnesota, and we help assist with reshaping child welfare practices and policies. Darlene works as a national representative for the Youth Law Center and a QPI national office, and we are no strangers to the child welfare system here in Minnesota. In fact, I am here today to represent the individuals who most are affected by the policies and practices, because I believe we are in the best position to design and implement change that the system needs to ensure excellent parenting and meaningful relationships for the children who are out of placement. Darlene and I both were familiar with kinship caregivers as 2 of the adoptions that we had were from our family. And we understand the dynamics of kinship versus foster care. And we learned firsthand the differences of foster care and kinship and the lack of support provided by to kinship, as well as the stresses imposed upon families who are forced into this situation and not given the type of support and training that they need. As a child, I lived in Chicago, and I lost my mother at a young age, at age 11. I was put into foster care, and I understand what trauma that brings upon children. And it caused me to be placed in foster care before I came to Minnesota, but as a child, I learned what kinship was all about because my grandmother had to raise me without training and without compensation. But Darlene came from a different setting. She had a 2-parent household, but she also saw her parents do foster care and kinship care. So she understood what that environment was about, too. Our experiences that I speak about make me passionate about QPI because we've seen firsthand the good, the bad, and the unfortunate of our child welfare system. For me, our goal is to go from good to great, from bad to great, and unfortunate to fortunate for the benefit of our children. As an example, I recently had four Nigerian children's placed in our home. And because they're of different cultures, we had to learn what the norms were that made them comfortable. So we had to reach out through comfort calls to their relatives because their parents were incarcerated. Well, we learned from relatives how to make fufu and pepper soup, which is a Nigerian meal, and that helped us bridge the gap for the children because we leveraged the comfort call, which was initially presented by QPI.
Ms. Brill, I have to ask you to wrap up pretty quickly.
Sure, sir. Our involvement in QPI has afforded us the unique opportunity to share our lived experiences with local, state, and county agencies and with other foster parents and with child welfare stakeholders. Everyone agrees that QPI principles would greatly improve and unify the approach of providing QPI or quality parenting for all children. We believe that the reunification becomes closer to reality because QPI principles are practiced when we have these discussion groups among licensed workers and foster parents. If only you will support House File 1672, QPI can expand its reach and provide those training opportunities and resources across the state. And I'll leave you with this quote from my beautiful wife of 39 years, Darlene Bell. She says, "If not now, then when? If not QPI, then who will do this work?" Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony and for your work for kids. Mr. Bell, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anybody, member of the public who wishes to testify on this bill? So not seeing anyone, so we're going to move to member discussion and questions. Representative Katiza Ratoon is on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks, for your work in this issue. I know that you have such a huge heart and you're living this personally and professionally. So it really means a lot when we have folks like you and Representative Daniels and myself and Representative Keeler, people who have experienced what it's like to be a part of the system and to really make sure that every child in Minnesota has a safe and loving home. I think that this type of programming is what makes it easier for people who have hesitations about becoming foster parents to do just that. And, you know, when we go through the process, we learn about all the things that these children have potentially gone through. It can be really scary, and it can feel like, oh no, how can I open my heart and my home to these kids when they might go back? They might leave me, and that it's the whole point, right? To make sure that they know that they are safe and they are loved when they have to be away from their biological family. So this is something, and I think a lot of people self-select out because it's too scary, and they think it's going to be too hard. And so I think that, learning a little bit more about QPI and the work that they do is something that could really help people say, like, okay, you know, there are systems in place to help me make this jump and to open my heart and to open my home. And I think that this is a really great initiative. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Ratoon. Any other member questions or discussions at all? So otherwise, I'm going to call on Lee Daniels, and then, of course, Representative Hicks to close. Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Another good bill by Representative Hicks. Thank you for doing that. The only question I had is how is QPI funded currently? Is there a funding source for them?
I thought I kind of maybe heard that, but I'm pleased to testify, Ms. Rickard.
Yes. So currently we apply for grants. So individuals such as like the Sauer Family Foundation has been a supporter. And then we have a nominal fee for those, 16 organizations that I commented on who pay $1,000 to kind of participate and support the work for everybody.
Lee Daniels?
Hey, I'm just missing. I was looking at my bill to get ready, to be honest with you.
No problem. That's fine.
But, I'm funded by grants and of course, we can't count on the grants to be there every time. So I just think it's a good program, and it's a small amount that we're putting in this bill. So I'm there again. We seem to agree on another bill.
Okay. So, that's good. Good trend. To the bill's author, Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair and Committee, and thank you, Lee Daniels, for your support. At the end of the day, my goal with the bills that I bring before this committee in this space is to make sure that children and families have the support they need to thrive. And trauma is icky. It's gross. Nobody wants to be in the situation where they are
working with the CPS system, whether they're a uncle or a grandma or a child or a foster parent. Nobody wants to be there. It's gross. It's unfun. It's hard. And anything we can do to support the people in that space at that time is better outcomes for those children. And better outcomes for those children is better outcomes for Minnesota. So.
Thank you so much, Representative Hicks, and thanks to your testifiers for your work, both of you in different ways, for taking care of kids. Really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. So members, with that, the chair lays over House File 1672 for possible inclusion in a committee budget bill. And so with that, Lee Daniels, you're up for a final bill. So thank you so much, members, for keeping us on track, because this actually gives us a little more time for this final bill, which is great. So Lee Daniels brings House File 612, moves House File 612, bring that before the committee. I don't believe, no, there is an amendment. And this one I will try to pay attention to throughout the rest of the hearing. So, Lee Daniels, do you wish to move the? Oh yeah, I can.
I'm sorry. Did you ask to move the amendment, Chair?
If you would like to move the A3 amendment.
Yes, I would, Chair. We've had a lot of discussion, different stakeholders, and the A3, it seems to be a good compromise. And so, yes, I'd like to move the A3, please.
Okay. So Lee Daniels moves the A3 amendment. Are there any questions, any discussion on that? Hearing none, all in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So the motion passes. The amendment is adopted. And we have House File 612 as amended before us. Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. I've been doing this 9 years. I've probably presented 30-some bills, and this is, to be honest, it's probably my most difficult one to present. It's not easy. The language in there is sounds like it's, you know, pretty heavy-handed, but it's something that is well, you know, long overdue. I've heard testimony after testimony after testimony. Where a deaf child in a hearing family had no services for until age 3 or 4. And one, if you read Mike Cashman's letter, he was 6 years old before he had any type of signing done for him to learn that. And that was actually at a boarding school. And he's, I think Mike's about my age, maybe a little older. To hear those stories of not having any type of language until you're 6 years old, and I hear it all the time. My son went deaf at age 3, and the chance of those people falling through the cracks and never being able to catch up is just scary. And so anyway, we started working on this bill about 4 or 5 years ago. And I think we've got it to a point where we can present it in committee. We know it's not perfect yet, but we're going to keep working on it. The A3 goes a long ways to giving some comfort to people that say you can only have sign language taught. I went to language such as on 1.9, including but not limited to, kind of open that up. And then on the amendment 1.14, for purpose of the subdivision, primary language means the language that a child uses or will, with a reasonable likelihood, use most frequently to communicate with others. A deaf child's primary language must be presumed to be form of sign language. And the reason that last part of it is in there is, I forget the percentage. My testifier will know the exact percentage of people that sign in the deaf community, and it's an extremely high number, so that's kind of why that's in there. It's the most common, most widely used. So that's why we're here. We'd like to see this. This would be the first one in the 50 states to put this language into statute. It's a little scary, but I think if we continue to work on the bill as it's being laid over, I think we can come up with a final bill that's presentable, and we can get it through, and and have it do what we intended it to do. So with that, I'm going to just turn over my testifier. And if everybody look at the letters, there's a number of letters in support. Doctors, we've had emails from people in the tribe. We've had social workers with letters of support. Just a wide spectrum. So anyway, if you get time to look through those, you'll see some really strong testimonies. So anyway, with that, I'm going to turn it over to my longtime friend and testifier, Sonny Wasilowski.
And to the testifier, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
So we're just going to test the microphone. Hello, my name is Sonny Wasilowski. I'm of Faribault, Minnesota. Thank you for having my testimony on House File 612 heard today in your committee. I was born and raised in a family that signs American Sign Language. My family and extended family members are a mix of deaf, hard of hearing, and hearing. From pre-K, I had access to an interpreter at school in Stuartville, which is south of Rochester. But then my parents divorced, and a month later, my mom sent me to the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf in Faribault. It was where she attended and graduated from. This place is a utopia, which is like summer camp to me. It's 100% accessible, barrier-free, language-rich. I had role models and peers that were all like me. They were deaf and communicated in American Sign Language. However, I was stunned to learn that in the classroom, many were severely behind to no fault of their own. Later in life, I learned that this was called language deprivation syndrome. This is not limited to students who later enrolled at the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. It occurs everywhere. It's statewide. Language deprivation is exceedingly rare for those who can hear. But for those with hearing loss of all intersectionalities, it is unfortunately prevalent. According to numerous research on language deprivation syndrome, it is linked to children at risk for cognitive delays, mental health difficulties, lower qualities of life, a higher level of trauma, and limited literacy. All of this is preventable by modifying the existing statute on maltreatment for minors to codify the provision to providing a child with access with language and acquisition of language, such as teaching American Sign Language to a deaf child and being in a language-rich environment. This bill is not to be constructed as punitive measure by any means. Social services are to be educated and trained to assist the family with resources, referral, and more for them to learn how to prevent their child from being severely behind of their peers in lifelong with various health risks. By passing this bill, the quality of life will be exponentially increased for many, including families of deaf children. I hope to go back home to share with my family, friends, and communities at large that we've at last ended the risk of language deprivation at the very start. Thank you for your time today.
And thank you for your testimony. And thank you for your testimony. We appreciate you being here. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion and questions. Members have questions? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Lee Daniels, for this bill. I do appreciate the amendment to include additional options of different forms of sign language. I'm sure you know this, but there are over 200 forms of sign language used around the world, and so it's really important that we don't limit this to just ASL, and so I appreciate that amendment and just wanted to make that comment. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Hanson. Other members? Well, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Daniels. Thank you for bringing this forward. And we've learned a lot about early childhood development, and I think even in the testimony, we've seen how developmentally it's so important to hear words, and unfortunately, when you can't hear them, there has to be another form. And I thank you for working on this. It's something that, you know, it's near and dear to yourself as, you know, you've got a son that, you know, is deaf and, you know, probably fortunately for your son was 3 years old when he became deaf. And, but, you know, for those that aren't, you know, having that ability to hear, I don't know if I could imagine what it would be to not be able to hear or think and, you know, when you get immersed in another language, you know, I you know, there's times I, it's been a while since I've used Spanish, but, you know, when I was in construction, sometimes I would think in Spanish because of some of my coworkers. And, you know, and not to have that ability, you know, and I appreciate you working on this and, you know, carrying it forward. And, you know, I know that there's some things that you want to continue to work on, and I thank you for that. And look towards seeing this come to light or fruition, and, you know, thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, I suspect, is a question for the bill's author, but maybe I'm just not tracking this. But in the amendment, you added this this subdivision D. For the purpose of this subdivision, primary language means that. And I am, maybe I'm just missing it, but I'm not seeing anywhere in the bill where the term primary language is used. Can you, I'm just trying to line up the language here. And the sort of the second piece of that is the concern I have is that the way I read this, and admittedly I am not a lawyer, but to me, I mean, to me the term primary language and the language used here sounds as though it's used in the singular, when we know obviously that that many kids use multiple languages, and in particular, you know, the language used most frequently to communicate with others. I know, you know, obviously we know as well that a lot of folks may use one language at home, and kids may use a different language at school and so on. So I'm wondering if you could just outline that language a little bit to me, and then, like I said, specifically direct me, because I'm not finding the term primary language.
Representative Boulder, I may jump in on that first question, just that the phrase primary language is in the amendment itself. So in the amendment that this new language is in. But Representative Daniels.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Okay.
Yep. Thank you for the question. I appreciate that, because this is a tricky bill that we want to make sure we can get it, you know, right. So it is on 1.5 of the amendment, and it just says before language, insert the primary language and delete such as. We're just trying to be more inclusive for, especially when we get down to letter D, that they may have different languages, like Representative Hansen brought up. There might be multiple languages. We had a couple emails, one email on the cochlear implants, and they wanted to use that. And we had it in one of our amendments, and then we took it out because cochlear implants by themselves is not a language. It can lead to language or can help with language, but it's not a language by itself. So we try to make it as simple as we can, giving leeway to other options. And I learned a lot. When our son turned deaf at age 3, we learned so much that he had fallen behind on. He never really got caught up until he went to the deaf school in 8th grade. I mean, he was a D-minus student, a bench warmer on the football team. They put him in the last 30 seconds of the game, like all compassionate coaches will do, put him in, the kids into play the last, you know, few seconds. And you know, we learned that if a child is going to speak a word, they have to hear that word approximately 2,000 times before they even try to speak that word. So can you imagine not even being diagnosed with being deaf until age 3, 4, 5, or like Mike Cashman's case, 6 years old, and now you're starting from square one. You have no language ability at all, and most of those situations, my friend Sonny Wazlowski here said most of those kids that don't get the language acquisition by age 3 will never catch up, and they will depend on Social Security for the rest of their lives. And that's just so sad to me that these people are, if we catch them before they fall through the cracks, they can be very productive. Sonny is very successful. His classmate, my son, Jeremiah, is extremely successful. But it was, in those two occasions, it was because the deaf school gave him a full language, and they were able to catch up. But I just can't imagine all the people that were missing. And, you know, even the shortage of workforce. We have my son started at Foldcraft in Kenyon 19 years ago, and he was the only deaf person there. And now they have five deaf people there that work. And it's so encouraging to see them take these jobs and be successful at it, earn good living, and, you know, have good benefits. So that's kind of the reason I don't want to see anybody else fall through the cracks, because the deaf school for our family and for Sonny's family and many families have turned their life around, but not everybody gets to go to that. A lot of people aren't willing to move their families 273 miles to be at the deaf school. And that's how I ended up here. That's how I ended up at Faribault. It was we sent our deaf son in eighth grade, and we still live in Bemidji, 273 miles from doorstep to doorstep, and it was hard, very hard. So I can't imagine other families, it's not any easier for them. So that's my goal in this bill, is to keep people from falling through the cracks.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. Representative Coulter, follow-up?
Yeah, just quickly. Certainly appreciate the goal with the bill. I think just as this moves forward, I think we just want to consider what the impacts that this could have for folks who speak multiple languages when we're using a term like primary language. So, thank you.
Thank you. I'm Representative Katisa Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Daniels, for bringing this bill forward. Again, I mean, it's a situation in which you have a really unique experience as a parent to a deaf child, and bringing this forward. Obviously, it's not just your family that's gone through this. There's many other families, and I think that representation is so important. So I appreciate you in doing this work and making sure that the voices of the families who have dealt with this are being heard. I don't know if it's maybe a question, maybe just more of a comment, but in looking at some of the additional language on page 2, like number 10 and number 11, I see, you know, number 9 is very clear to me at 2.17, to teach a deaf child sign language, and certainly what a deprivation that is, just based on the fact that they can't hear.
Representative Ortiz, though, I'm just going to pause you. That clause 9 was deleted in the amendment, what? Just to say. So the 2.17
and 2.18. We're having all sorts of trouble with amendments today. Sorry.
We are. No, I'm the worst offender, so I just wanted you to realize that those lines are out.
Okay. Delete. 17 and 18. Okay. All right. So some of the number 2.19
and 2.19 is still
okay.
It.
All that following section. Yep. So it's just the number 9. Okay.
Yep.
So that actually confuses me maybe a little bit more.
Oh, perhaps.
Because it seemed like it was like very specific to children who are deaf. And now, you know, I think, and there's some language included in 2.24 that says such as American Sign Language, but there's also, I think, the language surrounding that could be a little bit more wiggly in terms of interpretations. Like what I'm struggling with is on line 2.26, obstruction or deprivation of a child's accessible and cultural language, and then a child must have robust access to learning experiences. I'm not sure if that, like what that looks like or what that sounds like for somebody who is a mandated reporter. And I have concerns that there might be unintended consequences for, you know, parents who are working multiple jobs, people who are, you know, lower income families, whether or not their child is deaf. And so I think that certainly the American Sign Language and other signing languages, definitely critical, because this is a very specific issue for children who don't have the ability to pick up on other language that's happening around them if nobody in their home is providing that to them. But I just want to make sure that in modifying this definition of neglect, based on the conversations that we've had previously today about the child protection system and kids going into foster care, that we don't
unintentionally cause more cases to be reported to CPS because the parents just don't have the financial or the emotional or educational ability to provide this to their children. So that's kind of my question.
Lee Daniels.
And I appreciate that. That was kind of my concern. And when we started writing the bill, we had two different revisers that we worked with. And I think I asked that question, is it possible that these children can be removed from the home because they're not teaching sign language? That was my just ongoing question because I don't never want that, ever. And they both assured me that that would never rise to the level of neglect or endangerment, not like not feeding your child, not like, but in that neglect statute, it does mention education, which is kind of strange, because this actually leads to education. If you're so far behind, let's say you don't get any sign language or any type of language at all until age 3, 4, 5, your education experience will be normally horrific. Very, very few deaf children can catch up when they're that far behind. And like I said before, hearing for a baby to say its first word has to hear it approximately 2,000 times. And I believe that could be in the womb as well, because if you play music close to the womb, a lot of times the baby will settle down. So I know they can hear from the womb. So but that was my main concern. I don't ever want to have a child taken out of the family because of that. And they assured me multiple times it would never rise to that level.
Representative Cattese, would you follow up?
Great. I appreciate you asking that question and giving me a little bit more providing me just that input to help me feel a little bit better about the language in this and in terms of whether or not we if it needs to be fine-tuned or changed just in a little bit more specificity. But I do appreciate your work on this.
Thank you. And Chair Pinto, we are always willing to work on this. I think it's going to be laid on the table. We're always willing to meet and try to make it better. I don't think in 9 years of being here, I don't think there's been a perfect bill that's passed. So we're always willing to try to make it better and the best we possibly can, because it's really important. And I don't like to step into that section of law, the 260E, that is to tread on lightly, in my opinion. But this is so important, not to have people that are potentially could have a thriving life, a good job, a good family, and then have them set back just because of language deprivation. That's kind of what it is. And I mentioned before, I think I did, that this would be the first one in the country. And I think, and there was a worldwide UU, I don't know if you saw it in the handout, but this World Federation of the Deaf has a 4 or 5 page document in there. Talks a little bit about that, and I'm just proud that if we can get this through and get it past the finish line and get it right, that this would be maybe the leading thing for the nation to make sure that kids don't get left behind and because of their disability.
A full follow-up for some please between no, Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Lee Daniels, for this. I have a couple questions, mostly 2.28, it talks about that a child must have robust access to learning experiences as well as informal and educational environments at home and outside of the home. So my concern is that a lot of the areas in which children in general are removed from their home have a lot to do with poverty, have a lot to do with lack of access to resources in their communities. And this is just a learning question. Does Minnesota have a robust, community learning opportunity for our youth to get involved? I think more of greater Minnesota, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Minneapolis, St. Paul, there may be some, but what are we like as a state as far as these outside of the home educational environments?
Lee Daniels.
I might refer that to my testifier. His mom is very involved in deaf community. She was a president, alumni association president. but there are many. And I, for myself, my wife and I took classes at the community center, and the gal that taught it was totally deaf, which is great because then you had to figure out how to communicate with her, and that was 25 years ago probably took those classes, and a wonderful experience, great gal. But I think my testifier actually has probably more information on the local groups that meet.
Let's turn to Mr. Wozlowski. And just to stop for pause for a second, I invite the interpreter to sit down if you'd like to. Okay.
Hello, everybody. That's a really good question. I do want to make sure that the committee member knows that there are plenty of community resources out there. It's just a matter of making those connections. There are family mentorship programs that provide mentoring. There are deaf and hard of hearing services, the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division, that provides support all over the state of Minnesota. They expect to educate others. So if you send a child to camp or daycare and making sure that they can communicate and interact with everybody else, that's what the bill is doing, is just raising that awareness just to make sure that those barriers and preventative measures are not causing more of a language delay.
Vice Chair Keeler.
Is this thank you?
I believe so. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Any questions? No. Okay. Other questions or discussion from members? I have just a couple quick questions. This may be for Ms. Sunderman, but wondering if there's a definition of the term deaf child, or Lee Daniels, you may know, but in the there's references, that phrase is used in the bill, and I'm just wondering if it is defined somewhere.
I have a guess, but it's been, let's see, my son who's deaf is 43 years old, so this would have been 40 years ago we learned all this stuff. So I think I'll let
let's see if House Research is able to help us with that.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't believe there's a definition of deaf child within Chapter 260E. I would have to check the rest of statutes, but it's possible there is one in another section, and we could add a reference in the definitions in 260E if need be.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. Something else on this from you?
Well, forgive me, 40 years ago that we were probably explained this, but deaf is a certain percentage of your hearing loss, and my oldest son has, I think it's 80% a hearing loss on one ear and pretty much no hearing on the other ear. And that's very common to have, you know, severe loss. And so my son, if he came here and testified, he would probably just do it verbally with the surrounding area that's not, it's very quiet in here, so he could do a one-on-one, you know, talk. But he's got really good hearing aids now, and it's he's made a lot of improvement, but he voices very well.
I guess the reason, Lee Daniels, that I'm asking is the very last sentence of your amendment, now the bill, says that a deaf child's primary language must be presumed to be a form of sign language, and that made me think about what it means to be a deaf child. Could someone have some hearing loss such that their primary language is actually not a form of sign language?
Yeah.
So just sort of that's the kind of thing I was thinking about. Lee Daniels?
I appreciate that because it's, you know, this is not an easy thing to do. My son is just one of, you know, hundreds of thousands. Sonny's older brother is hard of hearing, and he now is, I believe, interprets for a medical company. I mean.
Yes, he's a certified deaf interpreter.
Yeah. And he's not severely hard of hearing, but he's, I don't know what his level is, but.
We do have a couple more questions, I should say.
So oh, okay.
We probably keep moving if we can. But might be just something to look at in the bill. That sentence jumped out at me. I think Representative Katiza Watun had a quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was just noticing in one of the letterhead things that Representative Daniels had included in our packets, there's a just note. It doesn't have a reference to statute, but it says, we use the word deaf as an inclusive term for all deaf, hard of hearing, deaf-blind, deaf-disabled, and late-deafened children. So perhaps elsewhere in statute, there may be that definition, so that might just ease.
Just something to consider as the bill as the bill moves forward. Representative Lee, you had a question or comment?
I guess, yes, question and comment. Okay. Just because we're talking about language, I wanted to see if there had been consideration given to families who may not have English as their primary language. I know it's wonderful if there are a lot of resources available, but I want to make sure that, you know, just because you don't have, you know, the ability to seek resources and the social capital to leverage some of these resources. I wouldn't want this to be punitive, especially for families who already, you know, aren't able to access services that they might need. And so I know we're laying the bill over, so I'd want to see if there be more consideration on families who, you know, may need these services but may not know how to access them.
Lee Daniels' response on that?
I apologize. I'm not sure I understood the question. It was hard to hear, but was it on not getting the correct language of a different?
Let's have Representative Lee repeat, and I'll just remind folks, we have just a couple minutes left, so Representative Lee, if you can keep it.
So, yeah, I'm reading, you know, the words on, you know, 2.19, failure, and, you know, I guess failure to provide, I'm curious what that means, because, you know, I'd want us to think a little bit more about the intention and the efforts that, you know, parents would want to put in to provide their children with, you know, the most resources and, like, the best foundation to grow. And I'm wondering, you know, if in putting this bill together, there's consideration given to parents whose primary language may not be English, given, you know, there may be resources available, but families who already have, you know, challenges accessing other services might need more supports.
Lee Daniels?
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I appreciate the question. We try to make it open for not just sign language and different languages in plural. And I think best, talking to my testifier, Sunny, over the years, is we would want to leave it to the local social worker, because they'll know the resources that are available in their area, and hopefully they can connect them with the right resources, and that would include, you know, different languages. So that's kind of, try to leave that open a little bit, language a little bit vague, so that it can be handled locally.
Okay, I think all those, any other questions, member comment? And Lee Daniels, I appreciate the work that you're doing on this, and let's continue to keep in touch. I know you and I have a regular meeting, and so we can chat more about this then, but appreciate you bringing it forward. And I appreciate your testifier, and again, the interpreter as well.
Thank you.
Lee Daniels, final comments, sir.
This has been good. This is, this is the most difficult pill I've presented in 9 years, because we get into that 260E chapter, and I just we have to do something. There's too many kids falling through the cracks, and we can work on the language. I'm perfectly fine. I know my constituent, Sonny Wasowski, is perfectly fine with amending the bill again and just get it in the right, and hopefully we can get it presented and passed through so that, you know, these kids don't end up on Social Security for the rest of their lives. It's just heartbreaking to see kids who have so much potential, but they don't have the right tools, and they fall through those cracks, and they never live to their full life's potential. So I appreciate the time, appreciate hearing the bill. Thank you, Chair Pinto, and the committee.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. And you had noted there are some materials in the packets in support of the bill. There's some expressing concerns as well, and so we'll continue to look them over. So with that, the chair lays over House File 612 for possible inclusion in a future bill. And members, with that, we are at 10 a.m. We are all done. The meeting is adjourned.